Before rock and roll, before pop, before everything, there was the blues. The music of struggle, triumph, and truth. Welcome to Talking Blues, where we honor the legends and tell the stories that shape modern music. Here's your host, Matt Cooper.
I'm glad you're with us right now. Aaron McCallum is a prominent voice in the Canadian Blues Collective. A big voice, big sound. That part you probably already know. But the real story, that's a little harder to see. The path that brought her here isn't the usual one. And the turns along the way say as much about the blues as they do about the lady. That's the ground we're about to cover, piece by piece, in her own words. And it starts right here.
Okay. So my brother started out being a musician, practically playing first. And he started out playing the bass. And so therefore, I just naturally gravitated toward wanting to play guitar because, you know, it's not a cool idea to copy your big brother.
How was the atmosphere growing up in terms of your relationship with your environment? Were you on the outside?
Well, I can say this. I grew up with two working professionals as parents, so I would be classified as the typical quintessential latchkey kid. And I think kids maybe who grew up in that era, I think it was maybe kind of the first of its time where two people, the mother and the father, they were working and kids were kind of left to their own devices, which is very true of my situation. So, yeah, I think just by default, you feel a little removed. And perhaps I have a running theory that kind of latchkey kid era that came in right in my time, I think that had a lot to do with, you know, even the music of, let's say, the early 90s with the alternative or the grunge movement where it was like, screw you, authority. So yeah, I think by default, you do feel a little removed from the fold. My musical interest amongst my peers was certainly different, having an influence of my brother, while at the same time, commercially, I guess there were bands coming out like the first boy band, New Kids on the Block, or rap was starting to make its entrance, early rap like the Fat Boys or LL Cool J. I was divorcing from that and heading toward rock and roll. I think that has something to do with having that feeling of being a little separated as well.
Were your peers, as you were young, were they into the same kinds of stuff that you were? Did you feel that? Or were your tastes going a little different?
My tastes were always just slightly different than my peer group just because I had the influence with the music in the household and my older brother. And so where at a certain age, let's say the tween era, you know, kids my age at the time, they were going toward the teeny bopper stuff and I was firmly rooted in rock and roll by that age. So I would say, yeah, my tastes were different.
So you're growing up in a pretty modern household. You've got two hardworking parents that are gone 9 to 5. Tell me about the point. Take me back to the time, if you can remember, where you first got that tweak. Was there a sound, a riff, a voice, something that altered the chemistry for you and said, wow, what is that?
Yeah, actually, if I could pinpoint something, for me, being rock-infused at a young age, I was always someone fascinated with words and lyrics. That came way before musicality for me. And I really liked the turn of phrase listening to Aerosmith. And I'd go, oh, that's a neat lyric. That's a fun lyric. And I gravitated really toward the music of that band. And I had seen an interview where Steven Tyler was talking about, oh, this is where it comes from. That's the blues. And I went, oh, well, that's the part of the song I like. You know, if you go back to, if I were to cite, let's say, an album, you know, around about the time of like Permanent Vacation or Pump, you hear songs on some of those albums. I believe it's on the Permanent Vacation album. Me and my old lady sitting in the shade, talking about the money that I made, singing, oh boy, right? You hear that, you go, man, I love that. What is that? And you hear in an interview where that comes from, you say, okay, I have to find stuff to listen to where it is all like that. What is this blues thing? And then shortly after that, boy, I heard B.B. King for the first time, and it stopped me in my tracks. Stop me in my tracks. What is this? This guitar, this is speaking to me. And it was all over at that point.
So the turn of phrase in an Aerosmith tune, the phraseology, the blues reminiscence, and then that investigative spark was lit in Aaron McCallum. You heard something that you liked.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, oh, I can find out more about this. And then the passion was ignited.
Yeah, back then, at least in where I'm from, there wasn't a huge amount of accessibility. So now I'm hooked. I'm hooked on the blues, right? I heard BB. That's what it was. And at that time, you know, you're listening through vinyl, and it's really hard to go to the local record store and find blues. At least it was in my case, because, you know, this is the time where if you take a snapshot, this is the time where you're looking at Permanent Vacation or Pump or the Appetite for Destruction album. That's what the record stores were full of. So I'm already on the outs. There's no designated radio program or radio station. And I'm way too young to get into bars, right? So you go, how am I going to find this? I need to grab all this music I can find. And for the longest time, it was just listening to rock and roll and trying to find artists that claimed it. You know, the Rolling Stones, Elvis, bands that were saying, this is where our influence is. So I really started going in that direction. And then I felt, I need to play the music. I need to find it somewhere. And so it was a long road.
The blues scene, where I've always felt I belonged. Let's unpack that statement, Aaron, if you would, please.
Sure. The way I see it, so it's the music for me. And so when you find something that just clicks, it's like home. Like I said earlier, all those pieces in rock and roll that just seem to be what scratches the itch or pleases the soul, when you find it, it's like, yeah, that's like, not to sound cheesy or anything, but that's like the tributary meeting the ocean. There's just a big drink of, yeah, this is what's right. And it fits. That's the closest to the truth for me.
Understood. So now we have the independent young lady who's loves rock and roll. She's discovered that rock comes from somewhere greater. There's something bigger and beyond. You've got a direct influence in the older sibling picking up the bass. And so you don't want to copy him exactly. So you picked up a guitar, which is a nice compliment to that. Tell me about that process. Were there teachers or influences that saw something in you at that time? How did the craft develop, the technicality of the craft develop for you?
Well, it's quite the opposite than having any kind of education, encouragement, or anything like that. I got a guitar before I knew how to play it, never had a lesson, and come from a time where, at best, you know, tape cassette, radio. So I eked it out trying to play what I heard in real time, so like the long, long way. And, you know, I was young enough. There was no possibility to do anything like go to an open jam. I was way too young. So, you know, it was a lot of trial, error, guessing, faking, and failing as a guitar player.
Well, that's the great teacher, which I think everybody who's experienced success will tell you. And success is built on failure. Life is basically that formula. And so was your brother in a position where he was encouraging you? Was there bass guitar jams going on?
My brother, in his own big brother, tough love kind of way, did his best to introduce me to the music business. He was in a gigging band. He still is. He still is playing. But he did his big brother way of trying to teach me things. He brought me to my very first stadium concert in my life. He brought me to two, actually. And they weren't blues shows. They were rock and roll. The first concert he ever took me to was a Rush concert, and he made it clear that it wasn't there for enjoyment. He grabbed me by the shoulders, and he pointed me at the stage, and he said, "Pay attention, because this is about the music." And he took me to my second show, which was, of all bands, it was a Kiss show. And he did the same thing. He grabbed me by the shoulders, and he said, "This is not about the music. This is about entertainment. You have to decide what won." And I guess the other pivotal thing is that my brother, like I mentioned, he's older. He was playing in bands before I was old enough to really play anywhere. And he got me into one of his shows with a stamp on my hand. I don't even know if you could do that anymore. Get a stamp on your hand if you're underage. And he put me on stage trial by fire. He got up on the microphone and he said, "My sister's going to come up and sing a song." And I was petrified. "What are you doing to me?" And he said, "You're going to do it. I just told these people you're going to do it, so you're going to do it." And I had the worst stage fright known to man. And he said, "The moment you are up there doing it, you're already past a point of any criticism because you're the one up there doing it." And I thought, yeah, you're right. So I did it. And that would be, I think, the greatest influence from him.
What were the first songs that you wrapped yourself around that really felt good? Singing, in terms of singing.
That's a really, really tough question to answer, because even outside of a band environment, that's just something that I hate to say, but I sort of underrated or undervalued singing, because I just always did it. I was probably singing before I was really talking in great sentences. So that's a really hard question to answer.
So for those who don't know, and if you peruse Erin's social media, you'll see that she is an alto tenor voice. And so let's unpack that just a little bit.
Well, if I could speak on that, then the word in a female with that kind of vocal range and timbre would be technically, it would be framed as a contralto voice, which is much, much lower than what you hear in an average female voice. And that's part of that's just the way you're made. And the other part of it is one of the things I love about blues for any singer is that it is honest and authentic, and it can come out whatever way you're meant to come out. I spent a good portion of my, let's call it first half of singing for the sake of entertaining, throwing those low tones away, because you spend your time listening to, let's give a fair example, a Whitney Houston or a Mariah Carey. And you go, "That's just not my wheelhouse. I mustn't be, you know, a good singer." Or, "This is the range of a man." And it took a long time to appreciate that contralto embracing of the low tones. But it's the truth. And I just don't think you can lie when it comes to blues.
And it does lend very naturally to that push-pull, give-take that the blues sort of sets up almost every time, you know, we turn it on. And so that must lend itself quite naturally to your ability to storytell and express genuinely when you're writing, I would think.
Yeah. For anybody who knows some of my catalog. My works are always in what's relatable. You're never going to hear a song from me that I've written that, you know, there are songs out there that are like super specific to the writer's personal experience that only they have experienced. And that's not how I do it. Yes, I draw upon my life's experience, but maybe I'm telling your story too. There is that common ground that I hope, you know, somebody can hear a song I've written and say, yeah, I get it, me too. And I don't think you can do that without it being authentic.
I don't think it makes a connection unless it's authentic. If it's not, you get what some of my other guests have referred to as the Bobby sound, what the record industry came out with after they put Elvis in the army and they tried to smooth over what was rock and roll. It was inauthentic, in other words.
Yeah, that's just it. And I think specifically in the blues genre, you can't fool a real blues fan. I'm not saying there aren't. It's open to anybody, so I don't mean disrespect when I use this word, but yes, you can have a quote-unquote unsophisticated listener who can love it and relate to it, and the words matter, and that's good. You know, there are people who think that blues has to be 12 bars in a shuffle, and, you know, there are people. So no disrespect to anybody who loves blues and relates to the blues, but I think the one thing you can't fool is a listener who's trying to relate, whether they're quote unquote sophisticated or not. I don't think it's possible to dress it up and have it be completely effective. Not blues.
Well, perhaps because it's got such a raw form of root to it. I mean, there was nothing dressed up about the early blues players.
Yeah, like to me, I think about it like this. Everybody's kind of got a definition of what blues music is, but I think at the core of it, so you get past things like what's the formula, what's the technical structure of a blues song, get past all that. And I think the blues is telling the story of somebody's personal experience as it happens to them. And maybe a spiritual is telling the story of a higher something. So if you're telling the story of your own experience, hoping people can relate, the second you try and polish it, I think it becomes less relatable.
If it's less authentic, then I think people will see through it. I see what you're saying there.
Yeah. So if you're trying to make a genuine connection through telling your story, in my case, I hope it tells a lot of people's stories. It's relatable to a lot of people. And I think the moment you dress it up, it's slightly problematic to your purpose. So if I was born with a lower voice, then let it be so.
So you're learning guitar. You've got an older brother who's teaching you by things he's saying and sometimes by things that he's not saying. And you're too young to get into the bar scene. This is before the internet, so research really comes in the form of vinyl, as you said, cassettes. So give us some insight into your thought process there, because you're a teenager now, and you've got the guitar under your belt. You know what it is that you like in terms of music. But, you know, in the world we live in, we all have to make a living. So you must have had a sense of practicality as well, because you pursued secondary education in journalism. Give us some insight into how that decision came about. And let's flush that out a little bit.
Well, that's a funny story. When I graduated high school, by that time I was playing playing the small gigs you would imagine. And I graduated, and my mother, who was she's very big on a secondary education, she said, okay, now what do you want to do? And I said, I want to write songs and sing songs for a living. And she looked at me like I was crazy, and she said, what do you really want to do? So I picked a field that I thought would get me close to music and kind of utilize it to get closer to it, find out more. Remember, I'm still in this kind of weird phase where nothing's accessible to me. Still not old enough to get into a bar. but old enough to love music that I can't find. And as a side, just as a side note to this conversation, I used to, actually when I was in college, when I first started going to college, I was still a teenager, still too young to get into a club, I used to go in Toronto, and I couldn't get in, but I could sit close. And if you sit with your back against the wall, you can hear it a little better. And so a lot of the artists that I actually play with on the scene today are those people. I was trying to just sneak and listen and hear something, get a new idea, learn something that I couldn't learn somewhere else. I did it the hard way, man.
Well, those are the real lessons, Aaron. Those are the ones that you end up putting to use, you know, with the other talents that you learn along the way. So you saw journalism as perhaps an extension of your love of storytelling, and you thought, well, maybe this will get me a little closer to the music. Probably a pretty good choice.
Well, I could say here's an interesting, totally related, connected to my blues journey story. So I thought, yeah, if I can learn and understand everything from this side, from like the media side of the business, I will learn something somehow. You know, at that time, there's not really a whole lot of help. There's no veteran musician that's going to take me under their wing or anything like that. Just a person who loves the blues and wants to play it. There's no peer group that's playing blues in my era, in my generation. And so yeah, that's exactly what I did. And I started using those journalistic, you know, interviewing, investigative skills. And believe it or not, I ended up making a cold call to the bass player that I knew to be in the Downchild Blues Band. And that was Gary Kendall. I cold called that guy as a teenager. And, you know, he took the time and he spoke with me. And I look back now and I laugh. I know Gary, actually. I've known him for a long time and even shared the stage with him. I had him play a bass in my band for a year and a half. And I asked him one time if he remembered that. He just said, yeah. So there's a direct connection as to how I was trying to utilize it just to learn something extra, right?
You reached out and you find that you know, a lot of other celebrities, blues musicians, no exception, have an open heart to those younger that want to learn. Unlike the relationship between Howlin' Wolf and Eric Clapton, for an example.
Yeah, some do. And believe it or not, some don't. And you know how it is. It's really, in some ways, it can be hard to get the acceptance of who you're trying to make your peers. I know that being a generation, let's say, younger than people who still play on the scene today. So sometimes it's not easy because everybody has their gig. And that's the thing about it. And sometimes, yes, you can come across somebody who's welcoming or willing to offer mentorship. I feel like my age was a slight factor in why. I don't know. In my own personal case, I had to figure it out for myself, really.
Excuse me while I let my huge mastiff out for a pee, just a sec.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, let's jump back in. You know, a lot of folks, when they hear the music that they love, you know, something stirs in them. Some of us then are inspired to pick up an instrument and say, you know, I got to reproduce that sound. I've got to do that for myself. Sometimes that happens as a child, sometimes as a teen, sometimes in your 50s. Take me back to the point where you had the guitar, you've already heard the rock, you've been inspired by the blues. Take me to that turning point where you thought, you know what, I can do this. I can make a living at this.
Well, I could tell you, I could touch it in my mind a lot more advanced, like chronologically. I could touch it in my mind before I could do anything with it. I was very timid. I spent a long time by myself trying to figure it out, shy, if you will, and doing it again the slow, long, hard way. and kind of afraid to share it with anybody because you're in this abyss of not knowing what to do. I really didn't have, with the exception of like, I can give my brother some credit for like interesting me in music and giving me a slight introduction to what the real truth is, if you want to do this. But as far as like mentorship, lessons, guidance, being able to jam with amongst your peers with a group of people, I had none of that. So there was a huge question mark. What am I doing? Am I doing it right? How do I do it? And so I spent probably a couple of years just in my room trying to figure things out. By the time it came to do a gig, it was very much fake it till you make it. Yeah, I could do that. Yeah, I could do that. And you really didn't friggin' know. It's just like, okay, let's just, all right, I'll go play with these people and act like I know what I'm doing. And that was really how it started.
Was there a point where you wanted to bring other musicians into your fold before you went public? Was there a kind of a friendly or otherwise jam scenario before you started to perform publicly?
Not really. So when I first started out playing sort of my own stuff in my own bedroom and all that, I was really writing songs, which, you know, at a young, tender age, you kind of think, oh, that's ripe for judgment, right? So no, I really didn't play with a bunch of friends or anything like that until it was go time. And I think it was probably a scenario like, hey, Aaron plays. You know, I would carry my guitar everywhere because guitar was everything at one point in life. And, you know, for someone to go, hey, Aaron, you play. And bam, trial by fire. That's probably how it happened.
I want to jump back and forth a little bit, as I'm wont to do. And in your experience at Humber, I was there probably about 15 or so years before you. I was trained on the elements of style. I'm wondering if they were still pushing that in the curriculum when you were there. And if so, has that found a way into your storytelling in terms of writing songs?
Not as far as music goes, but yes. Yes, it was still taught when I was there as well. No, because by the time I went to college, I already had a writing style. I think the things that you experience in music when you're falling in love with it, I think they really inform your approach. Yes, you refine. Yes, you grow. Yes, you learn. But there's that kind of nucleus. And I see it a lot more in myself as I get more experience and play with more experienced players who, let's say, have been on the scene for 20, 30 years longer than me, where they have a different well that they're dripping from. And it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm a constant student, but there's this, I don't know, germ or nucleus or epicenter from your first learnings that I think carries with me today. So I would say no. By the time I got to college and I learned a lot more about the media aspect or the promotional aspect or the how to do an interview or how to better investigate things I'm interested in. I learned a lot of that stuff. But as far as an actual songwriting approach or how I'm a lyricist or anything like that, no, I think that was baked into me.
When it comes to the identity of an artist, you know, it's kind of like your style carries your DNA forward. We've talked about your vocal style. Let's talk about a little bit about the different things that make up the characteristics of your style and your very unique identity and how that carries through with your music. It might be a tough question to answer, but I'm going to pose it to you anyways.
Well, I feel like I understand what you mean. So like stylistic approach. So for example, how the singing comes out. I would think I'm a bit of an expressive person in general. And by that, I mean, if we're in a conversation, I can be animated, let's say. So certain words, certain nouns perhaps have a certain inflection. And it might be different than how you would hear, let's say, a traditional vocal blues vocal riff. For me, it's just the truth. So I don't need to sing a certain riff, or I can do them. But if it's honest, a certain word with a certain punctuation, it just comes out the way it's supposed to come out. And I think that's true of every singer, every artist, especially in blues music, because like we said earlier, I don't think it can be polished to the point, or I don't think it can be polished and maintain full authenticity. So I think that's true of every person who's putting forward their original material, especially singers.
So that style and identity really comes from the true expression.
I think so. Like if I'm making a statement that has, let's say, heartache, heartbreak, or it's a big deal, I'm probably going to say it in a way that expresses it's a big deal. And I think that's maybe true to everybody, not even just vocalists. When you listen to a guitar player who's using their instrument as a voice, you wouldn't play 10,000 notes to say, I love you, or I'm sad. You would express it in a way that communicates and punctuates that sentiment, I think.
I'm fascinated by your craft in terms of songwriting and creating music, writing the lyrics, arranging the music, playing the music, recording it. Give us some insight into your methodology. Chicken or the egg? You know, what comes first? Is it a concept? Is it a lyric line? Take us behind the curtain, if you will, on that one.
Well, I think everybody's different, and some songs come with you get a riff stuck in your head, but other songs come with a line. Like I'm a lyricist first. Some people are very groove oriented, and that's just, there's no wrong way to write a song. For me, I'm always a lyrics first approach, and right down to the message, and then the music has to support that message. Like there would never be a big, chunky power chord song that's saying something gentle, if you will. So I've had this huge advantage over the course of 5 albums where everything is by my pen. So that's the lyrics, the melody line, the bass line, the drums, every element. And I've had the advantage of making it support that message. And so that's my approach, is what am I trying to say? What am I trying to convey that people can relate to? And so that would be, I guess, if you had to frame a methodology, that's kind of where I come from. What needs to be said, and how do I best put it forward for people to relate to it?
And if we could drill down just a little bit deeper on that, when it comes to a song, would it be approached by, I have an idea, I'm going to write a song about it? Or would it be, I got this line, this phrase, I'm going to build around that?
I think it could come from either direction. I'll give you an example. On my very first album, it's called 5 AM Blues. There's a song on there that did all right. It's a song called Ain't No Blues. Now, that song wasn't completely in my head when I first wrote it. I was inspired to write a song after Hurricane Katrina. And I thought, man, how bad would it be if not even the blues was left behind? So not even the blues was left behind. And that's one of the lines in the song. And so that was the germ of the idea in that song. And in other songs, there's another song on that very same album I'll pick any one of them. There's a song called Red Hot. And it's about just that. How do I convey that feeling? What does red hot mean? And how can I put that forward in every way that people can also relate to that kind of red hot? It doesn't mean anything without an explanation. And so I wrote a song around kind of captivating that feel. What does red hot mean? And so I wrote the music to reflect that as well. People can walk away with that feeling. So when I say I'm red hot for you, you know, people can walk away from that song and go, yeah, okay, I know what that means. So it comes from two directions, I think.
And when you're approaching it, do you find, for the most part, that you will, you know, the germ of an idea will come and you'll knock it out? Or is it like, well, you know what, I've got the idea, I'm going to do a line, and then I'm going to come back to it. How does that go for you? What's the sweet spot for you in terms of creation?
Well, I have books and books and books and books because I leave no idea undocumented as far as lyrics go. And sometimes it's a rhyme and couplet. Sometimes it's a verse. I find that the songs that make it to albums are the ones that just come. Probably my most recognizable song is a song called Complicated Woman. And that one came in 2 minutes, exactly as it's heard on the album. That's what I heard. And so, again, it can come from lots of directions, but I leave nothing undocumented. The ones that usually end up being songs, they're songs early on.
Do you find that journaling is a very therapeutic and valuable way to process your thoughts and to keep track of your concepts? Do you ever find yourself going back and saying, what was I thinking about a couple of years ago? Maybe I can pull a gem out of that I have a different approach to that concept now. Has that ever come across your radar?
Not really, and I'll say why, is because there's so much material that if I have a different thought, I won't rework a song. I'll just write a song with that intention. Like, I've captured that moment. There are a lot of songs that don't make it to albums, and that's okay. But they didn't make it for a reason. So there's this huge advantage. There's no wrong way to write a song. So yes, if I have a different idea or, you know, a different thought, I would sooner write another song. Because we're constantly growing, we're constantly evolving. You know, as musicians, as songwriters, as whatever, I view all my previous work that's been written, rehearsed and recorded and released, I view those as snapshots that are still relevant today, but I'm a different songwriter today, you know, so I'll just write something new.
Understood, as opposed to attempting to resurrect something that was written when you were a different person.
Yeah, if I still really believe in something or I know it's a great song that just didn't happen to be recorded, yeah, I'm holding on, waiting for it to come out and to be recorded or put on the record. But that's rare. That's really rare. So I guess there's exceptions to every rule. But as far as a concept or something like that goes, there's a good chance that it wouldn't just be a snapshot. Like a cool rhyme and couplet or a cool verse or, you know, a cool idea. Well, there's a good chance it's been turned into a song. So if it's there and it just hasn't been recorded, great. And I also think there's an element as well to the people you're playing with. There are songs that have been written that haven't been put on the record yet because there could be an artist that I'm working with, like a guitarist that I'm working with, that brings something to the table where you just go, aha, okay, now it's right. Let's do it. Not that anybody else was wrong, but, you know, it just clicks together a certain way. You go, yeah, okay, this can match the vision, if you will. So that stuff happens. But as far as reworking a concept that I couldn't express before, no, I'll just write something new.
Aaron, let's talk about one of the projects that you're involved in that I've I'm very impressed with, quite frankly. It's the Aaron McCallum Blues Legend and Legacy Distinction, recognizing musicians who've made a significant contribution to the Canadian Blues Collective. That's a really a great thing, and I'd like you to give us some insight into, you know, I think I know why you're doing that, but how did it come about, and what kind of feeling does it give you when you're able to share that recognition with people that, you know, really deserve it?
Well, yeah, I noticed. I actually thought about that distinction for a few years before I kind of figured out how to do it in a way that was good. I wanted to see, and I hadn't seen previously, a recognition program based on merit and for musicians. I haven't seen anything like that in Canada. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of recognition programs. They have their place, but I wanted to do something that also put something on the record out there, more than a piece of hardware or a popularity contest or a promotional campaign or a strategic alliance, because those things do happen. Also, in the last few decades, there are now blue societies, there are now award programs where they didn't exist before. So let it be based on merit. So what I did is I developed a recognition program that can recognize anybody who meets the mandate, whether they're living or past. That's the legend is living, the legacy is past. And I thought a way to make this really fair is for every one person who meets the mandate to be acknowledged as a blues legend, they then have immediate rights to pick up to two eligible musicians who meet the mandate who have passed. From there, all artists who are recognized with the distinction are written about journalistically. And that information gets published for anybody in the world to learn about the artists who are, you know, at the core of the Canadian Blues Collective, who have made significant contributions.
So, and you've had this going on for a couple of years now. It's right about 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. The first person to be named a blues legend was Chuck Jackson. Chuck Jackson has been doing what he does for over half a century. Notably, he's been the lead singer in the Downchild Blues Band up until their retirement last year. But Chuck makes a contribution in another way. I think it's the year 27 this year. He has been a founder and artistic director for a pretty substantial blues festival called the Southside Shuffle. And he has employed countless blues artists, whether they're emerging talent, whether they're known embedded talent in the Canadian blues scene. And for that, the contribution is immense. Chuck then acknowledged Jane Vasey and Hawk Walsh, who are probably most known for their work in the Downchild Blues Band. So you look and you go, okay, that's a solid foundation. And the list is growing. There's currently 7 people who have been acknowledged and documented. So my hope is for there to be a resource. Being somebody who has come up doing things the hard way, I would love something like that. Accessibility is important. And to find a way to provide that space for artists based on musical merit and contributions, I think it's the right way to do it.
I think it's a wonderful touch to give the recipients an opportunity to nominate 2 other artists that are no longer with us, because I think that really speaks to influences and roots and the celebratory nature of the whole passing of the torch of the Blues Collective. So I applaud you. And I couldn't help but notice your Behind the Curtain columns, which we've referred to with some delight throughout the conversation today. And I really enjoy your journalistic style, and that's not sunshine. I'm telling you, I enjoy it. As someone who is fascinated by documentaries and investigative journalism, I like the way you set up an interview, and I enjoyed reading through them, and it really kind of speaks to me. And as somebody who's fascinated with what makes musicians tick, it's really your behind the curtain series of articles is really like a treasure trove for anybody who wants to find out what's happening in the Canadian blues scene, what's happened and what's happening. And so hats off to you. I think it's a great thing. And it looks like you're got a good connection there with Sound Cafe. So I certainly wish you all the best with continuing efforts there. And I applaud you as you showcase blues artists. I think it's a great thing.
Oh, thank you. I love the idea that to go behind the press release and the promo, which happens so often, you know, everybody's trying to, like I think you said earlier, if you're not on fire, you're burnt out sort of approach. All of us need to work. All of us are working towards a project or working on a tour or you're doing something that's in the moment. And so often, artists don't get a chance to tell, you know, more of their story. And that's exactly what Behind the Curtain is supposed to do. Every single article that comes out is exclusive. It's never been put on the record before. And that's a tall order when you get into artists that have been around for a while. Some of them I've done my research sometimes for a decade before I can think of that curiosity that just hasn't been documented or hasn't been quelled. And that's the kind of stuff I would have loved to have found when I was looking.
I can imagine that's where a lot of the energy from that contribution comes from the younger blues musician that couldn't get her hands on enough decent information, you know, and the more mature musician now says, yeah, I'm going to make a change on that.
Yeah, that's exactly, I think, where it comes from. I'm learning too, right? So it's all kind of interconnected, right? I learn from the artists I speak with as well. And part of their story gets told, which is, you know, a double positive. Thank goodness to the Sound Cafe, who the editor-in-chief, Stevie Connor, he has given me sort of free rein. That's a tough thing, too, when you're talking about, you know, journalistic real estate. And, you know, I've been given that kind of freedom to take it in whatever direction, which I think is also serving the artist as well. So, you know, it's a bit of a match made in heaven, and I think it's worth it for the artist. I think it's worth it for the listener. And yeah, I'm learning stuff always as well. So yeah, I'm happy to put that stuff out there.
I don't think it would work if controls were put upon you in terms of content or format. I just don't think, speaking as a frustrated artist myself, I don't think that would work. I think it has to be, you know, Aaron, you obviously know what you're doing. Bring it, girl. I think that seems to me that was the way it's done.
You know, I think you're right. Any kind of limitation on content becomes, and I understand there are a lot of publications that they do have, you know, they're a conduit because they have an agenda. Either they're presenting a show or they're, you know, doing something through a publicist. I understand that. No judgment. But so often it doesn't get to the core of why the artist has a new album out, that kind of thing. There's just this beautiful kind of ingredient. Oh, these ingredients have come together as this beautiful mixture between, well, I am an artist. I know a lot of these people. I have this journalistic background. And now with the Sound Cafe, it's there to do. And thank goodness with the editor-in-chief who shares a lot of the values, especially with independent music, just let me do what I do. So you would know with your journalistic background to put, you know, limits on it. It becomes something, it's different very quickly.
It does. And it becomes something very unpalatable and undesirable for, you know, the populace. They don't know why they don't like it, but they don't. I think it's akin to dressing up a blues song. You know, you try and polish it and it's not going to work.
Well, there's this trust and integrity and musicology and journalistic practices that go with getting an interview with depth. And so, unfortunately, I do feel that a lot of artists are mistrusting. There's a lot of misquotes out there. There are a lot of agendas for certain things out there. And it's very hard as an artist if you think somebody has your words in your hands and, in essence, a little bit of their career in your hands. And so it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to manage correctly if you don't have that free rein. So, you know you're doing it too. You're taking a journalistic approach as well. So you know exactly that kind of perfect balance, that perfect mix has to be there to do it for any length of time.
It's exactly right. And I have found firsthand that if you take just a little bit too much creative license with an artist in representing them in any way, shape, or form, even with the very best of intentions, it can be an alienating thing for them. And that's not your intention to do it. But yeah, so it's a fine line, and no wonder, who could blame musicians for thinking that media people have an ulterior motive, something up their sleeve. I mean, artists have been at the losing end of business relationships for the last 100 years. It's gotten better, but not much. And now that we have this the freedom of technology, where, for instance, Aaron McCallum doesn't need anybody to sit and write, produce, with the exception you might bring in Jack DeKaiser to. Right. But with that exception, you don't need anybody to make your album and put it out. That wasn't the case 50 years ago. Now we've got a lot more control. So I don't blame artists for having that mistrust. Like, Matt, why do you want to promote me? What's in it for you? I get a lot of that.
Right.
But so I understand that.
Yeah, that is a thing. That's kind of why I took the reins. I'm writing pieces that feature other artists, and some people don't understand why I do that, being an actively performing artist myself. But it's exactly to provide space where that mistrust is well-founded. Music, not so much about a got-ya moment or a if it bleeds, it leads kind of attitude, but there are a lot of misquotes. And for some reason, because it's music and not maybe warfare, a lot of writers do take either liberties with quotes or they decide to write in some of their own stuff to either, help promote a show, or they didn't do their musicology, or they're used to it being like what's on the one sheet promotionally, so they don't really have any depth to the conversation. I thought we could do something about that. So I feel like the advantage is artists are getting their ability to talk about why they're doing what they're doing instead of what are they doing right now. And that's at the core of it. Like, the Sound Cafe has thousands upon thousands upon thousands of reads a month. It's available in multiple languages around the world. And that's kind of nice to have that kind of coverage. But to me, the most important thing is if an artist feels that they've been represented correctly and fairly, because that's kind of what it's about.
I can tell you that I was interviewing an artist and I was very excited and I was doing my best to represent and promote their appearance on the program. And I took, this was my mistake, I took creative license with the promotional copy. I wrote it like ad copy, and I used words that were promotional, not factual, and this upset the artist. And it wasn't a fabrication. It was a mistake on my part, and so I learned from that, and it was a learning experience. So no one's made more mistakes than I have, but I tell you, that leads to somewhere better.
Intention is everything. And it's if you have that ethic, I believe, if you have that ethic, that intention to do the right thing, and like I say, not have like a gotcha moment or an ulterior motive of a promotion or something you're selling or whatever, then, you know, it's a lot easier to get it right. Personally, even though it's, you know, music and not, you know, political reporting, or something where you can really get hit with libel issues, I still operate in the same way I would if I was a member of the free press. I still operate as those rules because this is somebody's career. This is somebody's intention in my hands. And for that reason, well, what the heck would I be doing it for if I didn't accurately represent the artist I'm speaking with?
Yeah, learning curve. Journalists don't have all the answers. We're doing our best. But tell me about legacy, Aaron. Do you think of that, or is that something, is it more like, you know what, just keep moving, keep the train moving?
Well, in it, just my own personal kind of philosophy in life is I would like to leave the world better than how I found it, do what I can. I try to serve the genre of music that is my life. I can't always be taking, so try to leave it better than how you found it. It's that simple.
I think if we can all adopt that philosophy, we'd be better off. And you know what? At the end of the day, you've got those five blues albums that you've written. That's your stuff there forever. That's forever on time as you know, recorded truth. And you've got your columns that go. Are you still doing the columns weekly now for Sound Cafe?
It's monthly for the Sound Cafe. Yeah, I still contribute. Now, this time of year, there's a little bit of flex. Again, thank you to the Sound Cafe. I mean, they're the editor-in-chief understands that for the substance of these articles, to have a hard, fast deadline, he's so, so gracious because it's the content that matters most. So this time of year, when everybody's really busy on the road, there might be a little flex in that. But, still a monthly contribution.
There's got to be some satisfaction, and I kind of know the answer to this, but it's got to be some satisfaction when you look at your five albums and go, yeah, I did that. And then you look at your columns there and say, yeah, I did that too, and that's forever on record.
Yeah, doing something to strengthen, like I say, this collective, this community that is my life, it feels good. For anybody that is, let's say, on the official platforms for social media for anything to do with Aaron McCallum, it's not all one band's journey. There's a lot of stuff on the, let's say, Aaron McCallum music page on Facebook that is just a general conversation. For example, there's a Support Live Music campaign that's just been going on. It can be well received by anybody. Take it. It's public. You know, there's been blues societies across the country that have run with that campaign. And yes, I feel good about that because if we don't nourish it, where will it be?
Is there a part of your story left unwritten?
Always. Yeah. As long as I'm here, there'd be something to say about it. Sure. I mean, just like we're all people walking through life. You collect things along the way. You evolve along the way. Certainly as a musician, certainly as an artist, certainly as a songwriter. And so, yeah, I feel like there's always going to be something unwritten and something left to say, for sure.
Thanks for being with us, Aaron, today. We'd love to have you back for part two really soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's a wrap on Talking Blues. If the blues speaks to you, hit subscribe, share the show, and let's keep the tradition alive. Until next time, keep it raw, keep it real.